Thank you for listening to The Spectator podcast. We've got a new offer. You can get a free Brexit butterfly mug, as well as 12 issues of The Spectator for just £12, if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/mug.
In February 1945, the Allies, led by Sir Arthur Harris and Bomber Command, destroyed the historic city of Dresden, killing 25,000, most of them civilians. For the 75th anniversary, Sinclair Mackay, author of Dresden, The Fire and the Darkness, and A.N. Wilson, join me, William Moore, to discuss whether it should be regarded as a war crime. You can read an edited version of this conversation in this week's Spectator. Sinclair, maybe start with you. Would you define the bombings of Dresden as a war crime?
It was a barbaric act. But yes, I hesitate about war crime because I think, as Professor Donald Hexham, I have to check his name actually, who argued elsewhere, war crime is a legal term and not a moral one. And it's a legally defined concept.
Certainly at one stage of 20th century history, it was a crime deliberately to kill non-combatants and civilians.
Yes.
Who weren't in the line of fire of normal warfare.
Indeed so, but there are then a number of follow-on questions that then come with the label war crime, which is, I suppose, first of all, who would you accuse of having committed this crime? Who would be held most responsible? Who would stand trial at that tribunal?
Well, I mean, one of the greatest columnists the Spectator's ever had, Auberon Waugh, regularly used to say what a pity it was in 1945, since they had the Nuremberg trials, not to have put Churchill on trial and indeed hanged him for this and the bombing of the other German cities.
Right. Well, actually, yeah, but it's interesting that, because I was, the other point that I was going to bring up about the term war crime is that this is certainly something that makes people in Dresden feel uncomfortable. The fact that there is so much focus on their city and not other German cities that were bombarded horrifically as well.
Well, I mean,
anywhere from
the
Hamburg
other person,
to Lübeck, from Essen to Hanover to Cologne.
When you read about the night of fire in Hamburg and pregnant women running along and on fire, getting into the canal, which was on fire, I mean, the whole place was an inferno. That was Harris, too, of course. Harris started with Lübeck, which is this charming, you bring it out in your book.
Yes. Here was
Thomas Mann's, it's Buddenbrook's town. This charming, he chose that because
and
it was
Sir
built
Arthur
of
Harris
wood.
But and chose it as a kind of laboratory. He chose it in 1942 as a target for bombing. Lübeck had no kind of military significance whatsoever. I think there might have been one submarine about 50 miles away. That was the closest it got having kind of significance. But Lübeck itself, Sir Arthur Harris viewed deliberately as a laboratory. Was it possible to create a firestorm? Because Arthur Harris had very little time, rather like the Luftwaffe actually had very little time for the normal kind of bombs and explosives. They wanted to create fire, that oldest, most terrible impulse of all, that kind of atavistic impulse.
Well, I've already said it out of the conversation, but in this recorded one, I'll say it again, not risk of boring you. But there's this conversation that W.G. Sebald quotes at the end of his book, Luftkrieg und Literatur, in which he says the Germans are right to look at what the RAF and the US Air Force did in Germany, but they must always remember what the ambitions of their leader were during the Second World War. And he quotes this conversation, which took place in 1940 over a supper table at the Reichskanzlei, in which Hitler says precisely what you've just said, Harris said too. We don't want ordinary bombardment. We must drop incendiary bombs. And Hitler said that one of the wonderful things about Goering was that he'd looked at the map of London and realised that, as he inaccurately says, 200 years ago there was the Great Fire of London. And London is so narrowly built, as they put it, that you could actually destroy the entire capital of the British Empire in a couple of days with incendiary bombs. So that was their ambition.
Yes.
That doesn't make our ambition to burn the German cities better or worse.
But it doesn't, except that I suppose there are two things one might say about Sir Arthur Harris and the whole business of firestorms generally. like a kind of small psychopathic boy, Sir Arthur Harris was fascinated by fire. And he talked about it in his memoirs. He talked about fire typhoons and fire tornadoes.
I think he even spoke about having dreams about fire. He liked dreaming of fire.
Really?
Which goes very chillingly with a bit that you quote in your book, where somebody says there was something so icy about Harris, that there was something abnormally cold about him.
Yet, at the same time, here we are in the midst of this global conflict, where both sides... Well, certainly with the Allies are just concerned to make it stop. What is the most effective way to make the enemy stop? And so Arthur House and Bomber Command, we're putting the focus on him, but actually it's not just him. It's Archibald Sinclair, it's Charles Portal. It's a whole sort of range of people.
Charles Portal, the grandfather of the Archbishop of Canterbury. Who was among those, certainly, who would have been on trial. If it was really a trial of justice at Nuremberg, those people would all have been on trial.
But would they, though?
I don't know they would necessarily all have been hanged, like Harris and Churchill, but they would definitely have been on trial. Because, as Harris said, Harris came up with the classic Nuremberg defence of himself when his accusation was made against him. You quote it in your book. He was only obeying orders. He was obeying the will of Churchill and Portal. Portal was the man who started the RAF.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's been argued by another historian, actually, that if we're looking for the people responsible specifically for the bombing of Dresden, you might as well put Clement Attlee in the dock as well, because he sat on one of the committees that approved Dresden as one of the targets.
And also, while we're at it, one has to remember the habits of mind. If you talk to anybody who was old enough to live through the last year of the Second World War, most people were honest enough to hear that when the bombs had dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, they felt simple relief that the whole thing was now going to be over. Of course, we can't imagine that ourselves.
No.
But they did. Perfectly humane, decent people in the West thought that.
Yes.
And likewise, the Harris argument was very widely believed in Great Britain, that if you just reduce the German cities to ash and destroy the German spirit, this will hasten the end of the whole war.
It was called morale bombing.
Yes, it was.
Exactly that reason. It was the idea. There were so many terms, actually. The language of the bombing campaign is absolutely fascinating. But I just wanted to return briefly to the science of firestorms. And part of the thing that fascinated Harris, and so many others, actually, scientists, even scientists to this day, this has some resonance with the Australian bushfires that we've seen recently. And again, the extraordinary kind of the physical phenomena were basically there are thunderstorms that created at the top of these fires, which then spread the fires further. And there was a suggestion this happened in Dresden and elsewhere too. But they're very, very difficult to create artificially. And that was part of the reason, with the iciest of blood, that Harris and Bomber Command chose Lübeck as a target to see if it was possible to raise this artificial terrifying phenomenon of physics.
Because Lübeck was a wooden... It was a medieval town with... The buildings had wooden...
And they had
frames
and atmospheric conditions
and
on
top
of that.
I mean, you couldn't have bombed a modern American town, for example, which had metal frame buildings nearly so easily.
Yeah. And so, yes, we're agreed that all area bombing in any conflict is repellent. And they would, it was understood to be repellent in the 1930s when it became technologically possible for the bombers to make these kind of vast incursions into the territory. Guernica in 1937. This is a moment when the entire world looks on aghast to see finally made flesh the hideous possibilities of this future warfare, this future total warfare. And in the wake of Guernica, you have even the Nazis saying, yes, there must be some kind of legal framework that we can somehow slot this into. And so certainly among the Allies, and particularly very strongly the Americans, saying this is something that absolutely cannot be allowed to happen. We have to set down all sorts of legal sureties to make sure that war cannot descend into this.
And yet there was always the dread phrase of Baldwin or whoever it was, the bomber will always get through.
Yes. And there are also the ways that in which it was...
Against, from a tactical point of view, you had to, as the Nazis, as we were still able to think of them, not just the Germans, had done Guernica, Rotterdam, and these other sort of atrocities against civilians, we would never descend to that depth. And then there comes a moment in all biographies of Churchill where you see that either he's been lying to himself all along or he changes.
Well, the moment seems to come sometime in 1940. It comes just before Sir Arthur Harris takes over Bomber Command, interestingly. You see some kind of switch flipping over in 1941 where there has been, the Bomber Command has been carrying out raids. They've all been wildly ineffective and inaccurate and just haven't made any kind of impact.
One of the very, very brilliant things about this book, and it is a masterpiece, this book. No, it is. Spare your blushes, because it brings in the whole history of Dresden, which I want to go into with you too, but also all the characters interlocked, the Bomber Command people and the Germans, but also you go into the extraordinarily technical, scientific thing of how do you manage to make the bombing more accurate. And one of the witnesses in this book is the chap who's not dropping the bombs, but he's dropping the lights which will light up the whole...
The marker flares,
yes. The marker flares.
And the indication flares.
There's a very chilling, because it's in a way so beautiful description by one of the German witnesses, that it's like watching a firework display, because suddenly the whole city at night is lit up by these marker flares, and you think that's the bombing raid. You almost think, well, it's over, and it wasn't too bad. And in fact, they're just lighting up the city, ready for the
again, in brackets, the children of Dresden looked at these extraordinary lights falling from the sky. Yes, they are like Christmas trees. You just have these amazing lights falling from the dark winter sky.
Where you say it's like Christmas trees falling from the sky.
These German children just absolutely could have mesmerized. How is it possible to sense the horror that's to come from this extraordinary sort of display? Coming back to when the switch is flipped, when it becomes somehow morally possible.
In a way, this is the key thing in Churchill's own life.
Yes.
The switch being flipped.
Well, we have to think about it. There was his very singular scientific advisor, Lord Charwell, who I think was the man who came up with the phrase de-housing, that the bombers should aim to de-house a population. That is so chillingly technocratic and so darkly cynical, too. All we have to do is simply de-house the population, and then their morale will go, and then they'll all sort of collapse. Like
the prof, as they called him affectionately, didn't they?
Yes. And so you see that Arthur Harris comes in on a wave of that. It's not that he creates this psychopathic belligerence.
And Lindemann really is a key figure in this, isn't he?
Yes, yes. And so then we have the bombing of Lübeck in 1942. Then we have the days-long bombing of Hamburg in 1943, in which some 37,000 people died.
All civilians, or nearly all civilians.
Nearly all civilians. And again, it's a figure that's just too great to kind of comprehend in any kind of meaningful kind of way. And in that, we see, again, this terrifying firestorm rising up into the sky, the very elements themselves being bent and twisted, the air turning inside out, lungs being scorched, lungs being pulled, organs being scrambled. It's altogether
too
terrible.
There's a bit in your book about Dresden, but it's happening in Hamburg too, as well as bits of ash rising into the sky, there are charred body parts floating because they've been so charred that they just turned into ash as you watch. And we are seeing livers and lights and human
hearts. It's rather like that scene in The Wizard of Oz, except it would be Dorothy burning as she went up into a bit of fire typhoon. But that's what was happening. Corpses were just simply whirling around.
And the stench in Hamburg particularly, there's a kind of barbecue going on.
Yes, and the rats got fat. The rats became, as one person said, the lords of the city, these obese rodents who dined royally as a result. So yes, Bomber Command knew what they were doing. We're not just talking about Arthur Harris, we're talking about an entire kind of organisation that goes all the way up to Churchill and all the different people working within that too. You can see that. I mean, I've quoted the physicist Freeman Dyson in the book, because as a very young man, he was working in Bomber Command, working on statistical analysis and things to do with geometry and angles of fighter planes and bombers. So in that sense, he was one step removed, but he was looking at his own kind of moral development as the war went on, and thinking, first of all, well, the Nazis are obviously such an intense evil that they have to be kind of destroyed by any kind of means. But then you can find yourself stepping back from that and back from that. You know, is it by any means? Really, by any means? Is the bomber really the means to do this? And in the end, he concluded there were no more excuses.
There's one very good thing about this book. I mean, there are many, many good things, but one thing I like very, very much about it, because it reflects, particularly we've been living through Holocaust Memorial and all that stuff going on too. One of the things which anti-Germans always like to say is everybody must really have known what was going on with the Jews and all the rest. In this book, you might say nobody could fly a Lancaster bomber over Germany and drop these terrible things without knowing what they're doing. But one of the things you bring out is the way that the young boys, some of them little more than teenagers, who were doing these things, and 4 out of 5 of whom were going to die.
Yes.
The casualty rate in bomber command was dreadful. They didn't actually know what they were doing to any large extent. There's been a tremendous dislocation of awareness because the bombers flew so high up. That's one thing.
Yes. So how could you possibly have any kind of sense even... So
the people who dropped the flares, you say, were flying as low as an ordinary office building now. So, I mean, they could see what was going on.
But those who were dropping the bombs were thousands of feet higher.
And also, they were consistently lied to. And you have an awful, really chilling thing on the night of the raid that they were told, these boys... the British boys who were flying over, that there'd been intelligence coming from the Soviets, from the Red Army, that the Germans were getting military supplies passed through the centre of Dresden, and that was why it was right even to bomb the Altstadt, the beautiful historic centre of Dresden, because that was just a made-up, that was just a complete lie.
Well, no, but actually that wasn't. There was German troop movement going through Dresden, and it was a very busy railway hub as well. I mean, in that sense, the railway marshalling yards were curiously extremely important to the German war effort such as it was in February 1945, and yet they were still fighting on with an extraordinary kind of vigour and intensity. No one in February 1945 thought to themselves, oh, this will all be over by May the 8th. They weren't thinking that. I mean, they knew that the Nazis were finished.
Some were.
Well, they knew that the Nazis were finished, but there was a bewilderment actually with about the energy and the venom with which the Nazis were still fighting on, with using children as soldiers, but still kind of fighting on. And it wasn't entirely that Dresden did have, it may not have been very much military significance, but it did have military significance. You had this, as I say, transport hub, road and rail, where there were large numbers of troops going through and material as well. But on top of that, all the factories in the city, which ringed the Altstadt, they were quite close in. They weren't wide out in the suburbs. They were quite close in to the centre of the historic town. All these mighty factories, Zeiss, Icon, onwards.
Places where you and I would have thought we were going to buy a typewriter, a wonderful typewriter.
Or a bicycle,
not
or a sewing machine.
Not so good bicycle, quite good sewing machine.
All these factories were devoted to war work, all of them. They were producing the technical components, they're producing ammunition. Now, you could say there's an element of bathos in that. You know, they're producing all this stuff, who's going to use it? The Nazis are finished. Nonetheless, as I say,
Did we know that? Was that known?
Yes. And that had been known since about 1942, 1943. There had been intelligence. There are maps in the National Archives now of Dresden, you know, before 1945, which show the city as ringed zones, and it shows where they think the main factories are, and they could broadly get it right with the
main
factories.
But you could just have bombed the factories.
But the factories are so close to the beautiful historic city.
Yes, but it's not a justification for firebombing tens of thousands of citizens.
No, but the other point I was going to make here, obviously that's not a justification, but in terms, again, of military value, February 1945 was not the last time that Dresden was bombed. The Americans returned. The Americans returned in March, and they returned in April 1945, literally 3 weeks before the end of the war. Now, if anyone is saying this is a war crime because the town had no military significance, they have to then ask, well, why did the Americans return to bomb it again? They wasn't out of bloodlust or revenge or retribution or any of those things. It was simply because they were targeting those railway marshalling yards and those factories. They were doing what they could to help the Red Army smash through.
Which in itself, of course, any of us who know what the Red Army were up to is absolutely horrific.
Which takes us into quite another realm. But yes, but then returning to... Yes,
about the Second World War, except for this story, and you said to them, we've just decided to go and kill tens of thousands of citizens so that who are probably leading quite decent and quite nice lives. Even Victor Klemperer, whose diaries you use so much, was leading a much nicer life in the 1930s than he would have been living it in Stalin's Russia. And the reason they're killing these tens of thousands of people is so that they can, for the next 50 years, Eastern Europe can live enslaved in labour camps run by communist thugs and murderers and mass murderers who have killed far more people than Hitler. I mean, that is a pretty chilling aim for a Churchill and his friends, isn't it?
Yes, but I doubt whether if at dinner they would have stated in so many words that that was their aim. Also,
they would have said
we are going to target Dresden because we are going to go all out to kill 25,000 people in one night. That would not it would not have occurred to Arthur Harris, even in his most kind of bloodlust kind of filled states, that that would have been a possibility. I think they would have probably assumed that, like a number of other civilians in Germany, in German cities, that the people of Dresden had proper shelters. I don't think they were to know that they didn't. That the Gauleiter of Saxony and the Dresden authorities had deemed the city not enough of a kind of threat to the bombers. To build any kind of proper shelters, except for the Gauleiter himself, who had a concrete bunker. The only person in the town who had actually a specific shelter. Everyone else was forced into extemporized shelters, which in the old the Altstadt, the historic part of the old town, had a kind of Gothic kind of intensity. These small brick cellars underneath timber houses, lit with kind of single light bulbs, sparse furnishings. It's all too easy to imagine what it must have been like to sit in these dusty places with small children, elderly people, refugees, and all these cellars had been previously knocked through so that you could move basically under the streets from cellar to cellar to cellar. And you could move basically all the way to the river in one direction and all the way to the great park in the other. There was almost like a maze of cellars underneath this historic old city. But that in itself proved absolutely lethal, because the extemporized nature of these cellars meant that when the bombs started falling and when the fires started rising, the poison gases started just whispering through, and people were poisoned to death without having any awareness that this was happening to them. There's the shortness of breath, people having heart attack. I mean, because
all this is described in the book, by the way. You say it's all too easy to imagine, but we, the readers, the grateful readers, don't have to imagine, because you've done it. I mean, you've been through the archives, and you've put through the witness accounts of all this.
Well, I would say, I mean, the Dresden City Archives have done the most amazing job in gathering together and collecting hundreds of eyewitness accounts, either in the forms of people writing them essays, people who were children at the time, or in the forms of diaries, or in the forms of letters and sometimes postcards that people sent to each other in the days directly afterwards. It says something for the German instinct for order, that just several days after this extraordinary cataclysm, the people who had survived it, people on the outskirts, the suburbs of Dresden, were sending postcards to friends and family in other parts of the country. And the postal system was
confident that they would get through.
Yes.
There's a particularly chilling bit in the Klemperer diaries that you quote, because he's been in this thing called the Judenhaus, where he has to live with the other Jews. But there are only about... How many were left? There was something like... 200 Jews.
Yes, it was 198 Jewish people left out of a Jewish population of some 6,000.
And because he's being, for some reason, this professor of philology is being used as a kind of safe pair of hands by the Gestapo. And the day of the raid, or the day before the raid, I forget which.
It is the day of the raid.
He's told the Gestapo to go and tell the others that they've got to get ready for outdoor work and pack
it's,
a bag.
It's Victor Klemperer who has to go around the houses of the surviving Jews in the city and hand them their deportation papers, which he knows.
They give him a permit to use the trams, because of course the Jews weren't allowed on
the Jews weren't allowed to use the trams. On this one day, Victor Klemperer is allowed to use the tram in order to deliver death sentences. Yeah. To these people, and there was no secret about it. He knew, everyone knew.
He describes in the diaries, but you quote the howls of people reading this letter, because
Victor Klemperer would deliver the letter to mothers, and they would take the letter, and the door would shut, and behind the shut door, he would hear the howls of grief and despair.
They knew what it was, even though all it said was, pack enough for 3 days outdoor work. which you're giving to some old lady of 80 or something.
Yes. Yeah.
They knew what it meant.
Yes. But this, you know, obviously, again, this is not within the orbit of Arthur Harris, is it? Because Arthur Harris is looking at Dresden, Bomber Command is looking at Dresden as one of a number of targets. It's not specifically Bomber Command saying, here's a particularly beautiful city that's rich in art and culture, let's really just stamp on it and stamp on the Germans forever. They're not doing that. In Arthur Harris's case, Dresden came number 4 on a list of targets that he preferred because they were industrial military targets, as far as he saw them. Magdeburg, Chemnitz, Leipzig came before Dresden as a potential target. So that's just, again, just bringing it back to the label of war crime and intentionality, because a number of people assume that Dresden had been targeted specifically as retribution.
Because it was retribution for the Baedeker bombs, because yes. Canterbury had been bombed, Exeter had been bombed, and we'd lost these beautiful medieval buildings and so forth.
Yes.
The reason I mentioned Klemperer and the Jewish population, tiny as it was, wasn't just to be sentimental. It was because, at the time, thinking of your question, what is a crime, You include in your book very properly that it was only months away from the moment where the bewildered Red Army have discovered Auschwitz, deserted.
Yes, and somehow, I found this extraordinary, but you read this in Victor Klemperer's diaries, that the news of the discovery of Auschwitz somehow whispered its way back to the surviving Jewish population of Dresden. You think even in war, there was no secret. They knew.
But it's, taking it before then, when Auschwitz was still up and running with the German military, there were people begging the US Air Force to use bombardment as a way of liberating it, or if it does destroy it, at least destroy it. We are in a kind of awful atmosphere in the last 12 months of the Second World War, in which there are people in a prison camp literally begging to be bombed. Because they think that would be a way of either ending the misery or liberating. And so, I'm not saying that as a justification of the bombing of Dresden, but that's the kind of atmosphere one's in, the kind of crazy.
Well, this is the point. You know, there comes a point, around late 1944, when the shadow line of rationality is crossed decisively, that you always expect great organisations to make rational decisions. And I just think that just kind of stops. Finally, it becomes much, much more atavistic.
The word you use a lot in the book, I've noticed, is nihilism. Yes. The word nihilism so much about the kind of mentality of the... of everyone in at that point in the war. It's just it's so bleak that you almost can turn a blank face to the
civilians. I think you can, because you become first of all you become so inured, and second of all there's exhaustion on top of that. There's a desperate impulse. How do you make them stop? How do you make your enemy stop? You just have to. You can see the kind of psychology, can't you? This kind of. You just have to stamp harder and harder and harder, and
what you don't notice is that you yourself have become so embroiled in it all that you are yourself doing crazy and, by ordinary human standards, utterly immoral, not just amoral things.
Yes, well, I mean, that brings us back to... I was very interested in the bomber crews, who, you know, you read their diaries now in the Imperial War Museum and other places, and you're reading the diaries and memories of the intelligent, sensitive young men. You know, they weren't barbarians, they weren't cruel, they weren't sadistic. They had volunteered to play an extraordinarily dangerous role in this war, knowing the risks of it, with kind of unfathomable courage, and doing so simply because they had the conviction that this was the way that the war was going to be won. But they weren't fueled by murderous rage. They weren't fueled by anything of the sort. And so, how do you? I mean, I found it fascinating, actually. Just how do you psychologically account for someone having the courage not just to complete one sortie deep into the heart of enemy territory, knowing that you could be shot out of the sky, your body's burning as a force of the earth.
And then that 4 out of 5 of your comrades have been.
And that you return to the base and you see all the empty beds that speak of all your comrades who have died. How is it sort of psychologically possible for someone to kind of have the courage then to go out again and again and again? And in fact, there were so many of these bomber crews who, having reached the end of their tour operations, then volunteered for more. I mean, that just seems to me kind of extraordinary. But again, to bring it, framing it within this the idea of war crime, you wouldn't begin to say, I don't think, that any of those bomber crews were war criminals. You know, the bomb aimers, the flight navigators, the engineers.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't say that.
But they were obeying orders.
Of course they were. But I think they were in a kind of crazy... I've known one or two people who flew in Bomber Command, and one of my friends at the Evening Standard flew in Bomber Command, and he said, you never met people who weren't in Bomber Command. And, they were kept isolated, even from other members of the RAF.
Right.
They didn't have these dangerous conversations such as we're having. And, I mean, one of them, who was at the Standard with me and your dad, he described... After the war, and they were still in Germany, they'd landed in Germany, and they were having a fag by the side of the road, and a public school educated army officer, aged about 25, drove up in a jeep and looked over and said, are you in bomber command? Are you responsible for all that, pointing to some smouldering ruin? And they said, yes, I feel terribly proud. He said, you bastards, and drove off. And it was the first inkling they'd ever had that anyone had a different view of bombing the German cities.
Right.
And he said the propaganda talks from Harris and from, obviously, more junior officers were wonderfully inspiring. They believed they were doing the work that we've both been talking about.
I'm sure they were, but at the same time...
they were finishing off the war.
I'm sure that's true, but no matter how inspiring, you still get glints in all of these kind of memoirs and letters where they're not swallowing it whole. They know, you know, it's a Miles Tripp who went on to become a great novelist, actually.
His memories are really good in your book.
His brilliant book, The Eighth Passenger, which I would recommend to everyone. It's just the absolutely crystalline and chilling and
he's full of doubts about it, isn't he?
And he's full of doubts because he knew that the other point about the Dresden raid was that even the Americans had approved the bombing raid in Dresden because the city was full of rural refugees who were fleeing the Red Army in the east. And the idea was that by creating maximum confusion, as they put it, in the city, the refugees running hither and thither, that would further hamper the German troop movements. But it was Miles Tripp, among other airmen, who thought about who had witnessed the German fighter planes swooping down on refugees in France, and thought, hold on, refugees? Really? Is that what we're doing? And there are accounts, elsewhere, of bombers who deliberately release their bombs off the target, out of what they think is out in the countryside somewhere, because they can't bear them. And I can see exactly what you mean about these hermetic bases, where there's just basically the bomber command and these men living this extraordinarily... wildly kind of intense life, almost like some sacrificial warriors. Again, there's something curiously ancient about it, isn't there? There's something curiously archetypal.
And it is, I'm afraid, a bit like the SS in that way. I'm not suggesting that their morality was like the SS, or they believed in all the necromantic rubbish of the SS, but they were kept apart as a special warrior caste. But it was partly because...
In fact, it was the literary critic David Lodge also brought out that image, didn't he? He said that certainly in films portraying Bomber Command, there is an element of the Holy Grail about it.
Yes,
there was an element of Knights of the Round Table. This gives the medieval chivalry somehow.
Can we talk a bit about the side recoil away from the events of Dresden? I mean, because you describe so well in the book how Goebbels' phrase of calling it terror bombing is actually then picked up quite soon afterwards by the American Associated Press, and then... But still in February, even the Telegraph is describing the Dresden catastrophe as without precedent and it's a great city wiped from the face of Europe. And then Churchill himself seems to step back from Dresden as well.
Well, there is a kind of moment, I think, sort of directly afterwards where you see it. I mean, the British newspaper coverage is kind of fascinating now because there's no... secret about what's been done to Dresden. You know, the headlines say, I think it was the Daily Mail headline just the day after, saying Dresden, a city in ashes.
And then there was an even more tasteful one with a bull in the china shop.
The Peterborough column essaying a little joke about the new version of bull in china shop. You know, sort of, thank you for
because
that,
of the Meissen column. Works.
Because of the porcelain and all the rest of it. And there is a moment where it's the British press... are seeing the kind of magnitude of it. And there is kind of analysis too. There's an Air Commodore who gives an analysis to the Telegraph of, well, this is, you know, this is what the Russians asked for, and, you know, before the ink was dry, we've carried out the mission for them, and it's all, we're all very much on schedule. The recoil starts with the use of the phrase terror bombing. First of all, it's Goebbels, but then it's an American reporter called Howard Cowan who uses the phrase in the report. He doesn't use it in a condemnatory way at all. He uses it actually in what he thinks is quite a positive way. It's, you know, at last, the Allies are using the technique of terror bombing. You know, what took you? This then made its way over to America. And also to the neutral countries as well. The Americans were the first to react with just horror. This is absolutely, first of all, not what they wanted the world to see, but also not how they saw themselves either. The Americans were very keen to point out that they had always been about precision bombing. It is a slightly laughable idea when technology amounted to a green light in a kind of goldfish bowl. And precision bombing to the Americans meant that the squadron of bombers who were supposed to bomb Dresden actually ended up bombing Prague instead. You know, that was that precision bombing for you. Nonetheless, the Americans recoiled first, but I think Churchill recoiled very swiftly afterwards. It was as if he could have woken from a kind of fever dream.
I mean, I know he tried at anything, as did Stalin, but he was in floods of tears, wasn't he, when he saw the coverage and realised what it.
Yes.
I mean, there was a kind of moral awakening, I think, probably.
Well, it's almost as if it's, with Churchill, you can never quite tell whether a door of moral awakening opens, and then
it closes.
And then it slowly closes
one
again.
One more brandy and he closes it.
But it's certainly that. It's certainly to the extent that he sent out a memo, which Arthur Harris received with cold fury when Churchill described this as we have descended to mere acts of terror.
Yes, exactly.
And this is, but Churchill, this is the same Churchill who a month previously had been saying, which cities in East Germany can we target?
I know. So I think, I mean, it's the only occasion in your book where I was with Harris there. I mean, he had been told to do this by the highest authority.
Yes, indeed he had, you know, and again, he was obeying orders. Churchill then rescinded the memo. He took it back a couple of days later, but the wound in Harris.
And then
by
there's the whole business, which is a very fascinating one in your book, and indeed in our lives up to this moment, of what do you do with a figure like Harris? And there was a lot of questioning about whether he should be honoured at all, for example, and the early I always forget what honours are, but I mean,
there was a risk of grand orders of Bath. And
he didn't get the full whack, did he?
No, well, he suggested that he wouldn't have wanted the full whack because if his ground air crews weren't being given the recognition
they were never
that they deserved, the ground air crews
they
didn't
weren't
get
given
the
distinguished flying crosses.
No, they don't, and he was he made the point that in that case I shall not be accepting anything from the palace or from which it would be a terrible thing to do given the snub.
Yeah. Our day, which even you're old enough, young enough, whichever I mean to remember, the Queen Mother, no less, going to St. Clement Danes Church and blessing a statue of Harris.
Yes.
Which for many people, I mean, certainly including your old friend sitting here,
yes.
Was a step too far. The idea of it's one thing to have to go past the statue of Haig in Whitehall. You can just about see what made people put up a statue of Haig. But
Harris.
In our day, knowing all we do know now and having all the complex thoughts which you've helped us have in this book, to put up a statue of Harris is...
Is it perpetually covered in paint, or is that just my imagination?
I'm sorry it's not covered in worse than paint. And in fact, if I had my wits about me and the time, I'd be constantly getting slurry and pig shit. And putting it over his head every single day of my life.
But here again, we have this. You wouldn't say anything of the sort about the memorial to Bomber Command in Hyde Park.
No, but for the reasons we've said, these are the young people who are caught up with it all. I wouldn't say anything of that kind. No, because I wouldn't dishonour the men who did it. But I wish it wasn't there.
But you wouldn't want to grant any kind of honour on Sir Arthur Harris.
No.
You wouldn't be tempted to see him as the misunderstood...
No, I'd like to think of him as being posthumously stripped of all his honours by Brenda before she died. And indeed, she should strip her mother of it at every honour too, for having the ghastly temerity to honour such a mass murderer.
What is that? I mean, I'm fascinated by the psychology of Harris. You know, you... going through his private papers in the RAF Museum in Hendon, where they're kept now, I hadn't been... What I found slightly unexpected was that he was so articulate. He could write.
Oh, yes, he could.
And he was witty. And also, when he was talking about his bomber crews, you know, you see drafts of speeches that he was going to make in Devon after the war, where he teeters on the edge of poetry. And it's a part of the fascination, the enduring fascination of the horror of the story, I think, is duality, isn't it? That you see this kind of duality in Arthur Harris. You a man who's affectionately nicknamed Butcher, and yet at the same time is capable of finer feeling. You know, you kind of know he is. You can see it in his writing. But then there is the duality that runs also through the city of Dresden too, and the horrible fascination of how it was that the most cosmopolitan, the most richly beautiful and exquisite in art and open to all people, how this fantastically civilized place could so swiftly embrace Nazism as closely as it did.
And there's a further deeper thing in your book, even than that, namely that there's another person who's divided self, and that's the reader. Because, I mean, we all do have a mixture of feelings, precisely for the reason you say.
I mean, you can't... obviously, when you're reading so many witness accounts in the Dresden City Archives, it's... The fascination, obviously, when it's coming from children, there were children who were born into that darkness. That's all they knew. All they knew was Hitler. All they knew was this world of Nazism. Anyone who Dresden who was a teenager in the night of the bombing. But the years before that, I was kind of fascinated by... you know, we had the first exhibition of degenerate art in 1937, but in fact, it came to Dresden first.
And you talk about Otto Dix in the book, which is a very interesting, wonderful bit, because, of course, he'd had the whole horror of the First World War.
Yes.
Which he was...
Yes, Otto Dix, this blazing the modernist who had the horror of the First World War and came to Dresden and... almost like a premonition, he had dreams night after night that Dresden had been burnt to the ground and he was crawling through the wreckage. And you can see this terror reflected in his art, which is now, a huge amount of it is displayed beautifully in Dresden galleries. A very good reason for going there.
There was a marvellous Otto Dix exhibition in Liverpool of those of us who didn't have the airfare to get to Germany.
It's probably cheaper to go to Dresden than it is to Liverpool.
Much cheaper.
So you have these fantastic, you have Otto Dix, you have Conrad Felix Müller, you've got Otto Griebel, you've got a city that's kind of crackling with kind of artistic vigour after the First World War, the 1920s particularly. You know, so much kind of artistic excitement that nothing could remotely, it's kind of at the vanguard of the terrific work.
And this is all coming out of and through a city which, in the beginning of your book, it's a very gentle book because you're telling us this whole story of this jewel of a city and everything that it represents, and the Frauenkirche and all the other wonderful churches, their musical tradition, the Dresden Opera House.
Well, it also, because it seems to be a city of slightly, that seems to be a step apart.
Yes.
Both geographically and also a step apart in time as well.
One of these places beautiful, and even the dear old typewriter factory that you describe, Betjeman would clearly have regarded it as probably the most beautiful building in the city.
Yes, yes. No, it was a very, very pleasing aesthetic. There's a Seidler now one. It's very, very aesthetically pleasing. So you have all these different strands of Dresden life before the First World War, after the First World War, in the 1920s, where all the way through, you know, even in the 19th century, you have Caspar David Friedrich. There's always something... There's always something slightly unusual artistically about the place. Richard Wagner composed and premiered many of his operas in Dresden.
He was the director of the Dresden Opera.
Yes.
And then
he got caught up in the aftershock of the 1848.
Yes,
in Dresden in 1849. He's there on the barricades.
That's why he couldn't work in Germany after that, because he was exiled as a revolutionary.
And so the point is that the Dresden, while it is this beautiful place, this jewel box, as Victor Klemperer described it, it was never quaint. It was always, there was always something at an angle kind of going on. It was always kind of interesting. And that's what made the takeover of the culture of Nazism so particularly baffling, because the whole Nazi thing of strangling the culture within its own kind of within its own kind of sweaty embrace, you'd think that somehow Dresden would escape that or not be able to conform, but
Well, you watch it happening in tempera because it's such slow motion and his diaries are so full. And you watch it happening even in the university itself.
Yes.
Little by little by little. The minds and the hearts being corrupted.
Yes, but at the same time also...
Partly by cowardice, of course.
Yeah, but also what you also see in the diaries of Victor Klemperer, you know, here was a Jewish professor who was robbed of his professorship very, very, very quickly, as by 1934, then wasn't even allowed to study in the university library. The Nazis deprived him of his books. He was obliged to have his cat put down quite early on because Jews were not allowed to keep pets. So there are 1,001 icy cruelties.
He builds the house just outside Dresden, and then they take the driving license away, so he can't get to the
there's so many things. But what you also see in the diaries of Victor Klemperer, and this is, I think, fascinating about the civilians of Dresden, you see so many small moments of kindness and generosity. And I found that almost as haunting as the cruelty. The cruelty we know about. We know about the horror of the Nazi regime. What you rarely see are those glints of light and humanity in the ordinary people. At one point, Klemperer is in a forced labour party clearing snow from the roads. He's an old man. He's got a weak heart. And the work supervisor is looking at him and then just very quietly goes up to him and says, actually, go over there, sit down. Just stop doing that. And then there are other occasions when people in shops, the Jews get miserable rations, but there are people in shops who very quietly slip in extra rations.
Yeah, I love that.
And there was, for all the cruelty, there were those kind of points of kindness and generosity. I found the most, in any story as dark as that, you always reach for those little points of light. And you see it also in the accounts in the Dresden City Archives, where in the midst of that unfathomable terror, this inferno that's sort of sucking bodies into the air, there are still people who are making sure that other people are all right. There are young people looking after older people. There are people looking after women with prams. If it were me in that terror, I would be in a fugue state of terror. I'd be panicking. I'd be being sick. I'd be crying, and I'd run. I'd have run to the far distant suburbs. I wouldn't have.
But I mean, what you do in the book, because as you say, the archive research you've done is absolutely prodigious. I mean, you could have filled a book 10 times this size, and you've boiled it down to 350 pages, and particularly the opening, the portrait of both historical portrait and the social portrait. You do get a sense of all these actual people, some of them people of prodigious brilliance and talent like Klemperer, and some of them just what one could call ordinary people. And there they all are, and that's what's going to happen to them. The inferno.
But
I felt about this book too, it is a metaphor book, because the flames and the chaos and the state of mind we've already described on both sides, the Allies and the Nazis, that they'd gone mad by 1944-5.
Yes.
That's what happens if you let the fire get out of control. That's what happens if you declare war. You know now. We can't have any doubts. After the First World War, you might have had some doubts. But after the Second World War, you don't have any doubts that if you start a war, look what Tony Blair did in Iraq, it's just a small scale, it gets out of control like a fire.
Yes.
And it makes you have these, by the end, plodding schoolboy thoughts, which one's constantly having. Shouldn't we really all be pacifists? And, I mean, the distrust answering on one side of the paper only, because and the answer is, your answer might well be, because there's a figure like Hitler and the Nazis, the answer must be no. So the awful question goes on and on.
The awful question goes on and on, because you then have to sit down and ask yourself, right, you're faced with Hitler and the Nazis, what is your approach? Do you take a Jeremy Corbyn approach of getting all sides around the table, by which you would mean just the one side around the table.
It would. But what's so horrific about this story, of course, is that the way of beating Hitler, admirable ambition, is that you do it with the Red Army, and you enslave the whole of Eastern Europe for 50 years in camps and dreams.
Yes, I mean, it's one of the spooky things. In the days before the bombing in Dresden, the people in Dresden had no inkling that they were going to be attacked by the Allies. It was the Red Army they feared. They listened at night to the booms coming from the distant hills.
You only have to read Anne Applebaum's book about the Iron Curtain and the advance of the Red Army, instructed to rape and pillage wherever they went.
Yes, although they threw out smoke screens in that. In Dresden, for instance, it was said that Red Army commanders have said there are no rapes, no mutilations, thank you. Yeah, there will be the most severe consequences.
But the evidence is overwhelming.
And the stories all the more frightening for being so weirdly kind of told in such a commonplace way that there were accounts in Dresden of young women saying, yeah, this was, you know, the Red Army took over the house across the road and we were all hiding in the garages and there were the girls throwing themselves out of third floor windows. You know, this after the unspeakable devastation of that the night of the bombing itself. Incidentally, I have to make the point. It's often people often get this slightly wrong about Dresden. It's assumed that the entire city was destroyed, but the city was basically the size of Manchester. And it wasn't the entire city; it was the historic centre of the city, which was still home to huge numbers of people. Some 75,000 flats and apartments were destroyed in that one night, but the suburbs and the areas across the river from the old city were broadly, could largely untouched. So there's a large amount of 19th century architecture.
Which was nearby, the industrial bit that you describe, all those factories, they were bombed.
Yes, and so you can see now in the city, if you go to Dresden now, you see the Soviet housing projects, which are still there, and which actually look quite a bit nicer than a lot of the housing projects here. Because they're so well maintained by the authorities. And those basically are the areas which had been devastated. But then you go out into the slightly leafier suburbs and you see the original 19th century architecture. And again, if you go down those streets in Neustadt, up towards the north of the city, if you didn't know the history, you wouldn't know that anything had happened there at all. So again, some duality and more crime, because again, it was also suggested that, you know, the bombing was carried out not just as retribution against the Nazi authorities, but also because Arthur Harris had it in his mind to stamp on German civilization, because he saw German civilization as being the root of Nazism, and if he didn't stamp on it, it would just simply start all over again. Now, there's nothing in any kind of record anywhere that suggests.
Well, you may say that, but I guess you're right about Harris, because you know far more about Harris than anyone. But gather 10 or 20 British people in a room and start talking about this subject, and you'll find that 8 out of 10 think there's something a bit dodgy about Goethe's Faust, or Wagner's the obvious one that they get going on, and there's something about the German soul, which is inevitably going to end up with Hitler, which is obvious, in my view, obvious twaddle.
Yes, but, and in my view, very much in my view too, it is a very obvious twaddle.
But you get it, you know, Luther's translation of the Bible is so much more anti-Semitic than other people's translation, etc., or whatever it might be, not realising the Bible itself is an anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth.
There was a fascinating story.
You get this all the time, and even I won't be surprised to turn on Radio 3, and although we're in the year of Beethoven and so far, every day has been wonderful escape from the Today programme, because you can hear Beethoven instead, that somebody is going to say the Fifth Symphony or something is actually Nazis.
This is cool.
It partly goes back to that famous essay by Thomas Mann about Wagner, that it was Nazi music without knowing it was Nazi music. And you know, the medieval Germans were Nazis.
No, but
Hitler would have been flattered to be told that.
But you wouldn't argue that Caspar David Friedrich led to Hitler.
No, you wouldn't.
You couldn't. But he was a great favourite of the Nazis, and for a long time his name was tainted with that. But now you wouldn't even remotely think that. You look at these extraordinary paintings, and the number of which, incidentally, seemed, I think, to have been inspired by the landscape of Dresden itself. These dreamscapes, basically, that he could have conjured. But coming back to, I'm stamping out Nazis. Freeman Dyson, again, the physicist, told this fascinating story about a post-war cocktail party that he went to, where the ethics of the bombing war were being discussed. And there was one rather smart lady there who said, well, obviously, we had to bomb the babies. It was important to bomb the babies. And he could have looked at her with incredulity. And he said, well, in 20 years' time, those babies would have grown up to be Nazis.
And I don't know why I'm laughing. I should be howling.
But you do wonder, kind of, that would be a cocktail party, kind of, you know, everyone's.
But you see, that is a very, very good example of what we're talking about. And it's,
but there's no evidence that Arthur Harris had any idea that Dresden had that enough culture to kind of stamp on, I think. He associated it with Dresden China,
it's
Dresden Shepherdesses.
It's something that
he wouldn't have known about the beautiful Baroque architecture.
Something that happened to us in the First World War, I think, in Great Britain. Because up to that point, there was Carlyle and George Eliot, and we naturally looked to Germany as a rich cultural, we were right to look to it as a rich cultural resource.
Yes.
And our cousins.
Indeed so. And in fact, actually, the one thing I loved again about researching the newspapers for this book, if you look at the newspaper adverts in the early 1930s now, and even actually after Hitler has come to power, there are so many tourist adverts in the popular press, in the Daily Mail, for Dresden. Come to Dresden. Thomas Cook's tours. Come to Dresden, and you'll have a special guide, i.e. a special Nazi guide, who will also show you through. But there's, you know, it was understood that the artwork of these adverts was portrayed Germany very much as this kind of centre of elegance and culture and civilization, even at the dawn of the Nazi era. This is if you wanted to be sophisticated, you went to Germany on your holiday.
I suppose I'm interested that if you wanted to buy into the logic of Harris and Bottomley and others, that the bombing of Dresden was a military necessity from a sort of morale-bombing perspective. I find it hard to square that with the fact that London itself went through such bombing in the Blitz, and obviously that hadn't done anything to change the British morale. So I just sort of wonder how they're really able to maintain that argument.
Yes, and indeed from Coventry in November 1940 onwards, the Germans might have thought, you know, they came up with the word Coventrate. We've Coventrated Coventry. But obviously the hope was to wipe out morale. It clearly did not do any such thing.
It's a very good point, because, I mean, people came up with it. They still come up with it, funnily enough, but, I mean, they certainly came up with it through the war on both sides. All the evidence is that it hardens morale.
Yes. Is there a single instance in history where the bombing of civilians has ever worked?
Because it naturally makes you very, very angry if you're...
Yes. And in terms of...
Your harmless grandmother's been
again,
bombed.
Again, it was Churchill who could have understood this. I mean, again, the bombing of Dresden, one of the reasons it was given, this would be a shattering blow to Nazi morale. The regime would dissolve instantly once they had seen the horror that had been inflicted. But it was Churchill himself who had said a couple of years previously, don't begin to think you can anticipate what the reactions of the civilian population are going to be under this kind of bombing. It will not be what you think.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely right. I mean, obviously he's drawing on British experience. You know, British experience in the Blitz.
You shouldn't have the kind of Captain Mannering's double thing that we are the plucky little people who can take it on the chin, and you know, we take our medicine like men and all that sort of thing. So if we're bombed, it makes us stronger.
But they're
a race of cowardly automatons who just doing what they're told.
But we come back to rationality, I think, in the end, again, don't we? Because you can give any number of rational reasons for justifying, even if you're looking at it from Bomber Command's point of view, for justifying sending 796 aeroplanes over, which in itself seems irrational. I mean, if you're going to go for a few factories and railway yards, does it really take 796 bombs to do that? But all those thousands of young men, you're willing to risk the lives of all those thousands of young men. I suppose you do find all sorts of different ways of rationalising it, but in the end, it just comes down to some awful ancient instinct, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's just, we are going to set this place on fire. And the results, essentially, Dresden is then bombed out of the modern age. I mean, it was the case with all the other cities too, but in Dresden, you had the particularly striking medieval image of the corpses which had been fished out of these makeshift cellars. Young Kurt Vonnegut was there. He called it corpse mining.
That was extraordinary to me.
And then all these corpses were decaying so fast that they had to be burnt where they were. So they had to build these pyres in the old market square on these kind of girders. And you see the images now. People were taking photographs of them. The images of just bodies piled high. And it is medieval. It is a medieval vision. And the bodies burnt where they are. You know, this is a city that has been removed from time almost, as well as space. It's just, it is a vision of hell.
Do you think then, I suppose just to finish, in terms of how Dresden is remembered, the Dresden bombings are remembered today, particularly by those who actually live in Dresden, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and about the kind of messages to take from it. I mean, you mentioned in the book, for example, that there are some sort of far right wingers in Germany who want to use the Dresden bombings to sort of make kind of martyrdom, sort of martyr complex about what happened.
And actually, I'd like to talk a little bit about this because it has become rightly a bigger and bigger thing in Dresden now. The commemoration. I was there for the commemoration last year, where first of all it begins where hundreds and hundreds of people form a human chain around the Altstadt, around this historic, rebuilt old city. And it's partly to symbolise togetherness and solidarity, but it's also partly to physically keep out the right-wing elements. All the people of Dresden are forming a human chain to say, you have no place here to the extremists. You will not hijack history. Because what the extremists want to say is that the civilians of Dresden were victims of an atrocity too, and in that sense, Dresden was equivalent to the Holocaust. The German civilians went through these atrocities too. That's the aim of the far right. And the Dresden authorities and the people of Dresden, the vast, vast majority of the people of Dresden are absolutely having none of that whatsoever. This to them is an unholy hijacking of history. To them, If you go there now on the night of commemoration, it'll be a much larger thing on the 13th this year for the 75th anniversary. I've seen the full schedule of what they're going to do. I was there last year when there's the bell of the Kreuzkirche rings out at 6 o'clock and there's absolute silence in the old market square. This human chain is there. Then there's a performance sometimes of Rudolf Mausberger's Dresden Requiem, which was composed specially after the war. Dresden Requiem specifically honouring the 25,000 victims of that night. It's an impossibly moving bit of music which weaves in all sorts of old German hymns as well as the various other melodies. I was there actually in the Kreuzkirche listening to it, having some tears in my eyes. Somehow there was an old lady sitting next to me and somehow she divined that I was English. And at the end of the Requiem, she turned to me and she said, "This is for Coventry, too." And I found that was almost impossibly moving. Dresden has been twinned with Coventry since, I think, about 1959, and there has been always a very strong British-German link. We helped to rebuild the Frauenkirche. We gave the Golden Orb, and there were very strong links there. Then, later on in the evening, at around 9:40 or so, if you go out onto the Old Market or the New Market Square, where you've got the Frauenkirche, and the Kreuzkirche, at 9:40, in the darkness of the city, under this kind of chilly February night, the bells start ringing, all the church bells. And they ring with incredible kind of violence and anarchy. It's a terrifying noise. That's the moment at which the air raid sirens started howling on February the 13th, 1945. And now, if you stand there in one of these market squares with hundreds of people gathered there in silence, listening to this terrifying noise, and you can't help it, you absolutely cannot help it, as if by reflex, you find yourself looking up at the sky and imagining the approaching bombers. It's kind of impossible to do otherwise. Then, after about some 20 minutes of that, about 10:03 p.m., the bells stop, and suddenly there's this extraordinary silence, and that's the moment at which the first bombs fell. And in those market squares now, it's a moment of pure silence and commemoration. People light candles. No one says anything. And it's extraordinarily haunting and kind of correct, too. It is the most beautiful way of commemorating. It's neither about accusation it's just incredibly grown up. It's an understanding that Dresden is an emblem of the horrors of total war. It stands now as a symbol, like Hiroshima, like Nagasaki. But they're also very much focused on the idea of reconciliation, that this simply must never happen again. And that's why extremists of either side, the far right or the far left, mustn't be allowed into anywhere near this. Because this is not... We've gone beyond accusations now. This is...
Yeah.
Well, Sinclair, Andrew, thank you very much indeed for joining me. And everyone should buy Dresden, The Fire and the Darkness as soon as possible because it's a magnificent book. Thank you very much.